I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and Happy New Year to our Jewish listeners. Rosh Hashanah started last night at sundown, and the White House is certainly hoping a new year will dawn when Rosh Hashanah is over at sundown tomorrow night. On Capitol Hill today, the focus shifted behind the scenes because of the Jewish holiday. With the dust still clearing from yesterday's stunning House defeat of the administration's $700 billion financial rescue plan. The Washington Post describes President Bush appearing drawn and frustrated at the White House this morning as he again urged Congress to pass the financial rescue package, the president saying the economic damage will be painful and lasting if the bill is not passed. Rick Klein is senior political reporter for ABC News. He writes the note for abcnews.com. And Rick, you're going to start us off today. And I'd love you to start with what is happening in Washington today.
Well, lawmakers have gone home for the holiday, for the Jewish holiday. The Congress will not be in session again until late tomorrow. But in this next 24, 36-hour period, there's a number of different things that are going on. There's a lot of strategizing to try to figure out the best course of action, and there's a few options on the table. One is to bring the bill back and hope that lawmakers will have seen what happened in the markets and see the light of day. Another one would be to start it in the Senate, get some momentum going where the votes are more assured, and then hope to pressure House members to do something. And then the other option would include making some substantive adjustments to it, either moving to the left and giving more protections to homeowners, for instance, or moving to the right and lifting some new regulations, including some rules regarding the way you have to value securities. So there's a number of different things, all designed to shake a few votes. And the other thing that everyone is doing is just trying to signal to the markets that something will get done, that there's very few people who think that this will be ultimately paralysis, that this is a temporary standstill on Capitol Hill, and that's it.
We'll talk about the economics of today as well. Do that in just a second. But something must be happening today. I mean, we understand that in the run-up to yesterday's vote, President Bush reportedly called nearly every Republican member of the Texas congregational delegation, and just four of them voted for the bill. Are the phones being worked like crazy again today?
Yes, and Barack Obama's getting in the action. At least they told us earlier in the day that he would be. I haven't heard firsthand that he's connected with any lawmakers. He was criticized for not doing so. There's obviously a presidential campaign going on, so there's sort of the outside influences, but there's also the inside influences. And I think though this is one of those votes where even the voice of President Bush or John McCain or Barack Obama doesn't necessarily have that much sway on members of Congress. Remember that all these House members, all 435, are up for re-election in 5 weeks' time. If they really think that this is something that voters would punish them for, then I don't think that they're going to come around. And indeed, most of those who are in battleground districts, really closely divided districts, are unlikely to vote for this and didn't vote for it before.
But, Rick, that begs a question we have, because we heard, frankly, it was Democrats. We heard Democrats saying yesterday this was so important that they were willing to lose their seats and understood that they would or might. So what do you think is really going on here? Is it that the Republicans and some Democrats who are balking at the bill genuinely believe it isn't needed, that the market can solve this problem, and if in the Darwinian shakeout some companies fail, so be it? Or is it that their constituents believe that and they are making a political move and don't want to lose their jobs? Or is there something else at play here? Because the Bush administration was able to convince Republicans to vote for the war in Iraq with the claim of weapons of mass destruction. Of course, there weren't any. Now, Warren Buffett, among others, has called these derivatives, you know, the bad assets that have caused this problem, financial weapons of mass destruction. And many Republicans in particular don't believe that they're there. Is there also a little problem with credibility here? Maybe, you know, the case of the boy who cried wolf.
There's a huge problem of credibility, and we started to hear that from Republican as well as Democratic members. Also, just there's so many factors that combine to make this difficult. Like I said, right before an election, the president that was able to convince Congress that there are weapons of mass destruction and that we needed to invade Iraq, that was a first-term, very popular president. This is a record unpopularity presidency, and there's only a few months left in the presidency, and these members of Congress are going to be around a lot longer, and they realize there's a reason for the unpopularity. Also, you have legitimate disagreements on both the left and the right as to whether this is necessary and or a good idea. No economist can guarantee that this is going to be the be-all and end-all. a lot of folks will say that it's not necessary, and we hear that particularly among some conservative Republicans who say the market should work itself out, that there's other ways to handle this, that we can't give $700 billion to Wall Street every time there's a big drop in the Dow. You also have liberal members of Congress who say this sure. actually doesn't solve the problem, because the big problem is that people are being kicked out of their houses. So you extend unemployment insurance.
Or give money directly to the homeowners, help them out. Dennis Kucinich voted against it. Michael Moore is against the bailout. Well, you mentioned economists. Rick Klein of ABC, I want you to stay there with us. We need your help. But we want to turn also to Peter Morici, professor of business at the Maryland School of Business and former chief economist at the U.S. International Trade Commission during the Clinton administration, and a former guest on Here and Now. Peter, welcome back.
Nice to be with you.
I just want to ask you, the dean of the business school at Golden State University called yesterday's defeat of the rescue package an economic 9/11. Do you agree?
Oh, that's a bit much. 9/11 was a definitive act. The building fell down. They can't be resurrected. Certainly, if they don't get busy and get something done, and then by the end of next week, things could come apart. The way recessions become depressions is the economy keeps unwinding and unwinding and unwinding, to the point where the hallmark of the depression was that it was not self-correcting. Recessions do self-correct. We could get into a malaise of 10, 12, 14% unemployment that we can't recover back from. One of the things that's going on here is a lot of people without much understanding are making bold and sweeping statements. The other thing is that you have to understand how Congress works, and that is most of the members of Congress are highly specialized. They serve on a couple of committees, and one guy knows all about public works and immigration, and another guy knows about, jet travel and telecommunications and so forth. And they tend to look to their party leaders for direction, and to other members of the House, even if they're of opposite party and they don't say so publicly, who they trust. Okay, hold on.
Well, go ahead.
Hold on. We had a problem yesterday, not with just with George Bush's unpopularity, but with Nancy Pelosi's speech. It was a very unfortunate statement on the part of a woman that wants to present herself as a national leader, to make such a partisan speech when she was trying to bring people across the aisle in a compromise for the good of the nation.
Peter, hold on there one second, because I do want to remind people, Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the House, got up to the lectern and spoke about how it was the Republicans who were the party of deregulation, free markets, and we were seeing the result. And just, Peter, one more second. Rick Klein, there was a lot of talk from the Republicans who came out after the vote and said it was Nancy Pelosi's fault, as Peter Morici is saying, in that this wasn't exactly the olive branch and the bipartisan reaching across the aisle that people were looking for. What's the sentiment in Washington about this?
Even Republicans have begun to back off of that claim that Nancy Pelosi somehow spooked Republicans. 12 Republicans changed their minds because Pelosi gave a speech. Barney Frank got up, I think, and called the bluff, said yesterday, said, look, I'll be really nice to these Republicans in the next couple of days if you give me their names. And I think if they were looking for a reason to vote against it, they could have found it in Nancy Pelosi's speech. But I don't think that forced members of Congress to skip or to change their minds on a vote.
But Peter,
I think the horse was out of the barn, and it was too late for Barney Frank to say that. I think the Republicans should have just kept their mouth shut and let people draw their own conclusions about it.
But I take your point, Peter, which is, where are the leaders? That seems to be your overarching point.
Nancy Pelosi has not behaved like a national leader over and over again. She viscerally dislikes George Bush, and at any given opportunity, she's behaving like a schoolgirl on the playground. Is that simple? Yesterday, she spoke like a ward politician, not like a national statesman. It was a very regrettable statement. She was asking the Republicans to vote on essentially a bill of attainder that blamed them for everything, and that was absurd. The reality is, deregulation was begun by Jimmy Carter, not by Ronald Reagan. Bill Clinton put a lot of pressure on Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to loosen up their lending standards, which unleashed some of this, although they were not the largest perpetrators of lousy mortgages. The Congress has oversight responsibility for the regulatory agencies, and it is now well documented that Senators Dodd and Schumer and others on the Senate Banking Committee are getting huge amounts of money from Wall Street to finance their campaigns.
Well, we jump in to say that John McCain's campaign manager, Rick Davis, was paid as a lobbyist for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and John Thain, who was the CEO of Merrill Lynch, is also one of his advisors. Plenty of blame to spread around. And you make your points, but here's my question for you.
Well, I'm saying it's basically, this is a bipartisan mess, and we have to acknowledge that it's a bipartisan mess and deal with it as such. This is a time for statesmanlike behavior.
Exactly. President Bush spoke today for a couple of minutes. He said the situation was bad, getting worse, going to be painful. Very generic. What do you think the president has to say that he's apparently not saying, because analysts are, research is showing that many Americans don't understand this. Now, I'm aware of listeners saying right now, wait a minute, I understand this perfectly well, and I'm still against the bailout bill. But there are others who don't. They think it's either just bailing out fat cats or bailing out someone on their street who made a bad purchase of a house. What do you, as an economist, think needs to be said to people so they can understand it hits them?
They need to have a believable spokesman, and George Bush doesn't qualify. You know, I'm not partisan in my view of this.
Obviously not. You work for the Clinton administration, and we just heard
you. No, hold on a minute. Hold on a second. Clarification. The International Trade Commission, is an independent agency. It has six political appointees. Three are Republicans, three are Democrats.
Well, I was just giving you credit for working under the during the Clinton administration,
well,
yet
really
being critical.
I really don't want partisan credit from you, and I don't want to be identified with the Democratic Party or the Republican Party. I make a specific point, because I'm a columnist as well as a professor, not to be politically aligned, and I would thank you to respect that.
Oh, sure.
Now, to get to the point, it really would take Nancy Pelosi to say some of the things that George Bush is saying to try to bring people around. But there are problems with the bill. The basic approach for refunding the banks was fine. It's the basic Paulson approach of buying the bad paper back. But there's not enough give back. The liberal Democrats are right about this. There's not enough give back.
Do you mean to homeowners?
No,
from the banks.
Buying in. Mm-hmm. I don't believe you can use this bill. I don't think you can use the bailout process itself to help homeowners. I think you have to have a separate title under the bill with direct appropriations from Congress that goes to a federal agency to do it. You would too much conflate the issue of working out the value of the securities. It's that simple. But this is how the Democrats have chosen to approach aid to housing, is by trying to use these entities as toys. That has gotten them into a lot of trouble, and they got to quit doing that. When I say buy in, the banks need to provide meaningful equity participation in exchange for this infusion of funds. The bill did not provide that. We only get meaningful warrants to buy common share as taxpayers if a bank goes bust. Right. If it takes the money and recovers, very nominal participation. We need real reforms in the way these guys do business so they won't get us into this mess again. Let's make no mistake about it. Ultimate responsibility for the mess lies in the hands of the financiers in New York and their compensation structures, and the bill was very weak on that. Nancy Pelosi presented it as being strong, but I went through the provisions, and it's weak. That's one of the reasons why I didn't think people should vote for it. I want a bailout, but I want one with teeth.
Peter Morici, professor of business at the Maryland School of Business and former chief economist at the U.S. International Trade Commission, a nonpartisan spokesperson in this. And Peter, we also have Rick Klein on the line still from ABC News. Peter, we're going to take a minute break. And when we come back, don't hold back, as if you have. But you and I have talked before, and I apologize if I said anything to insult you.
I just want listeners to be clear. I'm very, very careful not to align myself.
But also what I'm hearing from you is that your hair is on fire and you are very angry. And I want to hear why. After we take a quick break, we're going to do that. We'll, of course, be back as well with Rick Klein from ABC News, The Note, and Professor Morici. Find out what's going on Wall Street, what they think should be going on Wall Street and in Washington as we all weather this economic storm. Back in 1 minute, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We're back with more from Peter Morici, professor of business at the Maryland School of Business, and Rick Klein, senior political reporter for ABC News. Rick writes The Note for abcnews.com. Professor Morici just telling us, you know, how angry he is about the bailout bill not having enough teeth. He is for a bailout bill. Want more from you in just 1 second, Peter, but let me bring Rick back in. Rick, as you write, as The Note today reads, You write about the wreckage that John McCain crash lands as blame game infects Washington. How is that blame game that Peter was talking a little bit about infecting this process?
Well, it's a hyper-politicized process, 5 weeks out before congressional elections as well as a presidential election. And my point with that comment is that John McCain staked his reputation, his campaign, on trying to work this out. In fact, was celebrating his role in this as late as yesterday morning, saying that he was the person that was integral in making this happen. And he may have moved the process along, although there's accounts that suggest otherwise. But certainly, he is now associated with the paralysis that's going on right now in Washington. So there's a lot of finger-pointing right now. Of course, the McCain folks say it's Obama who sat this one out and decided to monitor the situation and wasn't making phone calls, and Democrats could have gotten this done on their own. But, you know, the Democrats will point back on the other side that the Republicans in the House voted 2-1 against this, despite the pleadings of their leadership in Congress, despite the pleadings of President Bush and John McCain.
But as Peter Morici was saying, he's all for a bailout bill. He doesn't think the one that was proposed had enough teeth. Peter, you were telling us that there's just not enough extracted from the Wall Street financiers that caused this.
I want to pull the teeth out of the Wall Street lobbying machine. One of the things that became very apparent to me as this unfolded is just how much influence they have with both Treasury in the Bush administration and among the Democrats, and Obama in particular. My feeling is that one of the things I would require would be a ban on political contributions by the banks and their employees.
You'd also would ban them from lobbying for 10 years?
Yep, at least. At least.
Well, let's...
I don't know that I ever want these guys lobbying again. They're much like a regulated utility now.
They should be, because
they've convinced us, well, you know, we're essential to the economy, and the fact is they are. And so we can't fail. Okay, if that's the case, then it's time to welcome to the Power Commission.
Well, let's talk about how essential they are, because many Americans still aren't making this connection. Alex Merck from Merck Fund says one of the problems he sees is that the general public really doesn't understand this, and maybe we need to see a few payrolls fail.
Let me bore you with some data. Okay, I know economists do this, but I'm going to have to fall back on being an economist. Until this year, 40% of the mortgages by value were provided by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and 60% were conventional financing from the banks. This year, it's 90% from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and 10% from the banks. And Fannie and Freddie aren't doing that much more business. The reality is 5/6 of the bank mortgage availability, mortgage funds available, have disappeared. Mortgage money has dried up. That's one of the reasons housing prices continue to decline.
But draw the dots. Oh, you just were starting. Draw the dots to the person who still hasn't felt this effect yet, if they're not a small business owner.
You know, it's the old story. I mean, if your neighbor loses their job, he's lost his job, but you haven't lost your job. The reality is that your house is worth a lot less than it would have been. The other thing also is that businesses can't get loans, so they're laying people off, and unemployment is rising. These contribute to an economic climate where it makes you more difficult for you to get a raise. Because the job market isn't as good as it could be.
What impact does it have, you know, on cash flow? For instance, a lot of people don't understand that small businesses, many of them function on revolving loans. They just keep taking out loans and paying them back, and many of the loans they take out are for payroll. Do you see that really having an impact soon?
Yes, I do. I do. That's what we're all frightened of. Now, the thing about it is that people have this view of the recession, that the depression in 1928, everybody was popping champagne and having a grand time, and in 1930, everybody was unemployed. It didn't work that way. It ground down. The economy went down a hill, you know, 45% incline for a long time before it started to turn back. What we're going to see is unemployment rising, job losses increasing, more and more neighbors without jobs, people taking jobs that don't pay very much, which we're seeing a lot in the Midwest, in Ohio, Indiana, West Virginia, Western Pennsylvania. We're going to see worsening economic – the kind of economic conditions we had in the 70s and 80s are going to come back, and those were not fun decades.
But Rick Klein, that kind of information – still isn't moving a lot of people in Congress. I'm looking at something from the Associated Press. They did some, they crunched some numbers. They said that the U.S. has spent $648 billion for operations in Iraq so far. The government now asking for $700 billion for a bailout. You could ensure universal health care coverage for everyone for 6 years with that money. You could run a country on $700 billion. It's more than twice the size of the economy of Denmark. You know, people are looking at this $700 billion in Washington. What do you think, with a couple minutes we have left, what do you think is going to happen over the next couple of days?
I do think they'll ultimately come to an agreement that looks substantially like it does now. They'll add some sweeteners for folks to get it in. They'll build some momentum. They'll scare people sufficiently. I think part of the failure of leadership that we were discussing earlier is that there wasn't anyone, and not a president, not two would-be presidents, not congressional leadership, who was able to impress on the American people sufficiently the danger of the situation,
mm-hmm.
and the need to act quickly. And this is, and I think, you know, there's a lot of blame to go around here. There's certainly it's not just the administration's fault. It's not just the Congress's fault. But people were asked to swallow a lot of money and a lot of danger in just being scared of the situation very, very quickly. And I don't think that education process happened. That's why members of the House were hearing from their constituents something much different. And that's why we had that extraordinary scene in the House yesterday. But I do think that within the next few days, there's sufficient momentum for something to happen that we will get a bailout package of some kind and some size.
Peter, do you agree?
Yeah, I do. I think that Nancy Pelosi is going to have to be less partisan, because then it would make her cries to her colleagues more legitimate. If she really walked into the Democratic caucus this afternoon with George Bush arm in arm and said, look, you know, we have our differences, but haven't you seen McCain and Obama get together on this? This is real. We honestly believe if we don't do something, the country's at risk. We've all postured enough. We need to get this done now. He's willing to compromise. I'm willing to compromise. We're willing to make a deal.
Let's do it.
And then we want you to vote for it. And that's it.
Peter Morici, professor of business at the Maryland School of Business. Peter, we're going to send you a nice cup of tea.
Oh, thanks. Chamomile tea. Make me feel better.
Rick Klein, senior political reporter for ABC News. He writes the note for abcnews.com. Gentlemen, thank you both.
Take care. It's been a pleasure.
Of course. We'll continue to follow the fate of the bailout bill. And after the news, what would Warren Buffett do? That's coming up in just a few minutes, here and now. So what would the Oracle of Omaha do? As Washington continues to grapple with the bailout of Wall Street, many eyes are on Warren Buffett and the second richest person in the world, according to Forbes, and chair and CEO of Berkshire Hathaway, has been shopping. Yesterday, he invested in the Chinese battery maker BYD, and the company's share price nearly doubled. And last week, after word of the Bush-Paulson proposed $700 billion bailout, Buffett announced he would invest $5 billion in Goldman Sachs, a move USA Today called vintage Buffett. Now, why is that? We thought Buffett hated the current stock market structure. In 2002, he called derivatives, those contracts based on the future worth of something like a mortgage, financial weapons of mass destruction. But the New York Times wonders, maybe Warren Buffett could negotiate a better deal for taxpayers than Washington can. Well, Vahan Genjigian is Forbes' chief investment strategist and editor of the Forbes Growth Investor. He's also author of Even Buffett Isn't Perfect, What You Can and Can't Learn from the World's Greatest Investor. And Vahan joins us. Welcome back, Vahan.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, let's start with what we can learn, because in addition to, you know, calling derivatives financial weapons of mass destruction, Buffett's also been critical of investment banks for taking too much risk, charging fees that are too high. At the time of the Goldman Sachs purchase, you said he was signaling confidence, but what else was he doing?
Yeah, you know, that's a very good point. Warren Buffett does not like investment banks. He's been very critical of them. But Goldman Sachs was one investment bank that he always spoke of very fondly. There's a banker there named Byron Trott who has brought a number of deals to Buffett over the years, and Buffett has always praised this guy. So if he was going to invest in any investment bank, Goldman Sachs would be the one. And his investment certainly does signal confidence. The day it was announced, there was a big rally, especially in Goldman Sachs shares. But in classic Buffett fashion, he has created an incredible deal for himself and his Berkshire Hathaway shareholders.
Because he has a lot of ownership now of the company. Tell us about that.
He invested $5 billion in preferred stock that pays a 10% yield, which is quite generous. And he also received warrants to buy an additional $5 billion worth of the common stock, which will, when exercised, will make him one of the biggest shareholders on record.
It gives him a 7% stake in Goldman Sachs. But do you also think that Warren Buffett was sending a signal to Washington by investing $5 billion in Goldman Sachs? Because critics of Washington's bailout bill have said, well, why not do it the way Sweden or Japan did it in the 90s? The governments put money invested invested money right into the companies so that they'd also have a bigger return when the companies rebounded. Critics of the bailout bill say Washington is only buying this bad stock to get it off the market. They want a deal that maybe looks more like Warren Buffett's than Henry Paulson's.
Well, yeah, certainly Warren Buffett is a master of structuring incredible deals that are in his favor and in the favor of his shareholders. And you could certainly argue that there are many flaws in the government's plan. But no, I don't think Warren Buffett was trying to send a signal to the government with the deal that he structured. In fact, he said that the reason he invested in Goldman Sachs to a large part was based on the assumption that the government would proceed with the plan as originally proposed.
Well, now as we know, the Congress so far has failed to pass the bailout. Shares of Goldman Sachs fell yesterday along with the financial roof, the stock market losing more than $1 trillion in value. So is this Buffett maybe straying from his strategy of minimizing risk?
Well, no. He's always willing to take calculated risks as long as he thinks that there's a potential for a big payout. And even though Goldman Sachs did fall yesterday, as you pointed out, the stock is actually rallying today with the rest of the market because there is an expectation that some bill will pass by the end of this week.
Is there a sense on Wall Street of what would Warren do? Or is he so unique in his thinking and his financial backing to do things like make a huge investment like that?
Well, yeah. I mean, of course, everybody wonders what Warren would do if he were the Treasury Secretary, and I have no doubt that he would have proposed something different.
Well, what would you think he would have done?
I think he would have done something more like the deal he structured with Goldman Sachs, using some type of preferred securities, perhaps providing insurance for these financial securities rather than buying them outright. But he has said that the plan as put forth by Secretary Paulson is a good plan. He's not really opposed to it.
Well, today, as we said, Buffett is buying stake in the Chinese battery manufacturer BYD. The company plans to sell electric cars in the U.S. by 2010. They're one of the world's largest makers of rechargeable batteries. This isn't an investment in General Motors, which is also in trouble. So what signal is Buffett sending here? Is it about China or green energy or both?
I would say both. He knows that we're going to eventually rely less on carbon fuels, and we're going to have to rely more on things like battery-operated cars. And this is not an investment that he's hoping to make a lot of money on next year or the year after, but it is an investment that he's hoping to get a very generous rate of return on over a very long period of time.
I wonder if there's a comparable time to compare Buffett's actions now and then and the results. We know that Buffett made another major investment in Wall Street Bank back in 1987, the time of another major crash. But that investment didn't go very well initially.
Well, that's right. I actually point that out in my book as an example of a troubled investment, even though, believe it or not, Buffett actually made pretty good money on that investment. That was Salomon Brothers. He had to step in and actually run the company. He was the CEO for a while, and this is something that he does not like to do.
After he invested $700 million in Salomon Brothers.
That's right. So he will step in and take charge when it's necessary. And because of the troubles he had with Salomon, many people thought he would never again invest in an investment bank.
And here we have seen him do so with Goldman Sachs. Well, you know, what happens now? Do you think that Warren Buffett is the person everyone seems to be looking for, the Lee Iacocca, the Roosevelt, you know, the person who, the business leader, who can stand up and speak to all America, which is right now pretty divided on the bailout?
Well, he's certainly the one business leader that probably has more credibility than any other. He's one of the most respected individuals in American business, not just because he's been so successful as an investor, but because he has always run his businesses very ethically. And people have been waiting for quite some time to see, you know, when is Warren Buffett going to put up his money and get into these financial securities that have fallen so much. And he's finally done it. And I think this is a real signal to other investors that this is not the time to be panicking and getting out of the market. This is the time to be thinking about buying more.
Although, as you said, he seemed to see it as a partnership with the government, which would also be pulling all of those bad assets off of the market with the bailout.
Well, that's right, yeah. He believes that these securities have to be taken off the balance sheets of these banks in order to allow the banks to continue lending to one another and lending to American businesses. Because as I said before, if the banks are not willing to lend to consumers and corporations, and many companies, by the way, have to constantly borrow on a short-term basis in order to even do things like make their payroll.
Sure.
And if they can't do that, the inevitable result will be greater layoffs. We'll have a much higher unemployment rate, and that's a sure recipe for recession.
And that's where Warren Buffett stands as well. Vahan Janjigian, Forbes chief investment strategist and editor of Forbes Growth Investor, also author of Even Buffett Isn't Perfect, What You Can and Can't Learn from the World's Greatest Investor. Vahan, thanks as always.
Robin, thanks for having me on.
Okay, as we pause to breathe, a quick reminder that before we go today, actor Greg Kinnear, you're listening to Here and Now. Okay, no more breathing, because we want to look at hand-drawn maps. Now, you've probably scribbled one out on the back of a napkin to give someone directions, or maybe to remember a hiking trail. Well, don't throw it out. Hand-drawn maps have achieved a new status. In fact, they have their own association and website. Chris Harzinski is founder of the Hand-Drawn Maps Association. He's also the creator of handmaps.org. You can get to it at our website, here-now.org. And he joins us now. Chris, what drew you to these little scraps of paper?
I was going through some boxes of old papers, getting ready for a move, and I found a bunch of these maps that I had kind of accidentally collected.
Accidentally collected?
Yeah, they were maps that friends had drawn when I visited a place, like go to Chicago, and, you know, here's some places you should check out while you're in town. And as I found them, you know, I started realizing that the, like, memories of those events became kind of recreated in my mind.
Yeah.
So, you know, I just found them really interesting because of that.
Well, because there's something so human about them.
Yeah. I think that they have a lot of personality to them.
Well, now it's grown, and on your website, people are submitting their hand-drawn maps to you. Can you just tick through the titles of some of them? For instance, map to my friend Fred's house or to a fishing hole. What are some of the maps?
We have a map to Barack Obama's campaign headquarters in Houston, Texas. We have a map a couple of people drew while they were sitting at a bar in St. Paul, Minnesota, talking about the Large Hadron Collider. So we have...
Over in Switzerland, right.
Yeah, I'm kind of interested in how some of these maps actually are documenting major events, you know, just while people are sort of talking about things.
Well, I'm looking at map number 64. It's from David Donaghy. He created a map for his GURPS, his Generic Universal Role-Playing System, so it's some kind of... is it an online game that he does, or offline?
Yeah, I believe it's the online role-playing game.
And it's astonishing. It's mountains and
Very detailed.
There's Tanaloth and Burion and all these like fortresses and things.
Yep.
So some people actually get quite detailed with them.
You know, we have maps that are quickly drawn on a napkin, like you were saying, and then other maps that people are spending, you know, hours creating, you know, imaginary worlds.
Well,
you know?
here's one of those quickly drawn maps, number 22, but it tells a whole story. This is a map that Lola submitted. It's entitled, I Heard You Broke Up With Your Girlfriend, Here's Where to Find Me.
Right, exactly.
It's got, I'll describe it, it's got a little square at the bottom, your house, since she kicked you out. And then it's got a road. It looks like Route 95. And then there's like some scribbly circles that we all do for bushes. And then there's another house, and it's her house. And then there's a well. Well, maybe I shouldn't say this. Well, it's online, so I suppose I can. There's a key in the well for the house if he wants it.
Right.
I mean, there's like a couple little items on this map, but it's a whole story.
Yeah, and I think it becomes very, you know, revealing of, you know, personality. You know, things also that even though we might not relate to that specific story, you know, we relate to the sort of generalized story, you know, that's taking place in the map.
And what are people saying to you about, you know, why they want to even participate?
I think people like telling their stories to each other. The maps, even though they may not be intentionally creative, some of them might just be, you know, quickly drawn, I think that they really, you know, reveal a lot about a place or a lot about a person.
Where do you hope to go with these maps?
Well, right now I'm just interested in collecting them online, sharing them with people. I think that, you know, the internet is a great way to share stories with each other in a kind of collective way. So, you know, right now I'm just focusing on, you know, getting as many maps as we can and sharing them with other people.
Did I read somewhere that you were thinking you might want to just, you know, go set up a stand somewhere and actually have face-to-face contact with people and collect maps?
Yeah, I am actually, you know, hoping to tour the Map Association at some point. I'm, you know, looking into that right now and kind of setting up some venues where that can happen. So,
but you can actually meet people.
Yeah, yeah, and, you know, collect maps face-to-face.
Well, and they could also send you maps how to get to them.
Yeah, exactly.
Here's where to find me.
Yeah, exactly.
Chris Harzinski, creator of the Hand-Drawn Maps Association and handmaps.org. Thanks so much for doing this. It really is fascinating to look at them. Thank you, Chris.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, coming up, if you're in your car and it's raining, notice how the windshield pauses? We'll tell you why it does when we come back. That's in 1 minute, here and now. Flash of genius, that's the phrase the Supreme Court uses to define an idea that inspires an invention. It's also the title of a new film that tells the story of Robert Kearns. Kearns was a college engineering professor living with his large and loving family in 1960s Detroit. In the blink of an eye, their lives changed. In the family basement, Bob invented something called the intermittent windshield wiper. It blinked or paused, giving the driver a second-long break from the wipers. We take it for granted today, but back then, Kearns and his wife and their six kids piled into the family car to test it.
Hey, hey, hey! Oh, you see that car across the street?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Look at the driver's
yeah.
staring.
Oh, yeah.
He thinks I'm turning the wiper on and off here. Look at this. No, no! Look here! Look at that, mister! No hands! He's wondering what the heck's going on!
Bob Kearns dreams of having his invention, the Kearns Blinking Eye Motor, in every car in America. He and his friend, Gil Previk, who works in the industry, take it to the Ford Motor Company, where the engineers are astounded that Bob has solved a problem they'd been working on for years. Later, though, Gil gives Bob the bad news.
They want out, Bob.
Who wants out?
Ford.
What?
They're just not interested anymore.
Bob is devastated, even more so when a few years later, Ford comes out with a new car with an intermittent windshield wiper. Bob Kearns' real-life David and Goliath battle to prove Ford stole his idea was first told in a New Yorker magazine article and now in the film Flash of Genius. And joining us in the studio is director Mark Abraham. Welcome.
Thank you.
And the film's star, actor Greg Kinnear. Greg, welcome to you as well.
Thank you very much.
And I want to start with you. In watching this film, one phrase rises up. There has to be a special place in hell for people who steal other people's ideas. I'm just wondering, we know that you studied home movies, and a clip of Robert Kearns on David Letterman. What did you want to bring about this guy to the film?
Well, I wanted to bring his very unique humanness. I mean, he was not an unflawed man. And unlike the David Goliath stories sometimes you see in the movies where the protagonist is painted in these great heroic colors, this guy was a real man. He was short-tempered and abrasive and prickly and untrusting. In spite of all of that, though, I saw this kind of underlying dignity in the guy, and I desperately wanted him to succeed.
Well, you know, you say prickly and untrusting and angry, but who wouldn't be, you know, after something like this? I mean, you wonder at some point, he loses his job in this fight, he briefly loses his mind, he loses his marriage, and I'm wondering, is he ill and irascible, or who, you know, wouldn't anybody be that way?
Sure they would. And I think what we tried to do was magnify those kind of idiosyncrasies and those shortcomings of this guy and show that the case was having an effect on his life. Because in talking to his children, all indications were that, you know, he was a different man, you know, 12 years later after this whole thing started than he was when it started.
Mark, this is your directing debut. You've been a producer. And we do understand that Kearns' family was hesitant to make it at first. So you have a little bit of pressure there to get it right?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't modulate how right or wrong it was based upon my commitment to the Kearns family. I would have done exactly the same thing no matter, you know, who they were. In this case, this is a tough family. They've been through a lot of litigation, so you knew that they would challenge you at every turn. And Bob challenged me in the early days on the telephone about why to, you know, how to make the movie.
Oh, so he was alive when you first spoke
with
him?
Oh, yeah, he was alive. Because I first optioned the material almost 9 years ago.
So what were those conversations like?
The conversations with him would be exactly what you would expect after having seen the film. He was nervous about how the story would be told. He wasn't certain that it would be told the way he wanted it. He at one point said to me, "How do I know that you're just not going to option our story and take it and sit on it, never let it come to light a day?" Or what about if you were going to take it and tell the story about the Ford Motor Company being the heroes?
He really thought that might be possible?
Yeah, he did. He thought somehow it might get his words might, as Rudyard Kipling said, twisted by knaves to make a trap for fools or something, you know? But I explained to him that even in Hollywood, that wasn't a particularly good story, the idea of a corporation crushing a little guy.
Right.
That didn't really get people that excited.
Well, you can understand as you watch his life story how he might fear that, because they were winning every step of the way. And now Kearns ultimately goes to court, but before that, there are points when Ford offers to settle with him once through a lawyer that Kearns had hired. He's played by Alan Alda. Here, that lawyer is telling Kearns, take the money.
They'll bury you with motions, injunctions, countersuits. They'll drown you in so many irrelevant documents that you'll wake up with cold sweats. And 5 years from now, you won't be any closer to seeing the inside of a courtroom than you are right now.
Here's Robert Kearns' response at that dinner.
I always thought I was put here on this earth for a purpose. I thought it was to be an engineer or maybe an inventor, but that's not it, and now I know what it is.
God put you here to sue the Ford Motor Company.
Look, I brought these here thinking that you had different ideas. Edwin Armstrong invented the FM radio. Somehow RCA ended up with a patent. He jumped out a 13-story window. This was a good man. He was an inventor. And look, I have letters from people. People who've had their ideas taken from them. They've heard about us. They're in their backyards and their garages, and they're counting on me.
Greg Kinnear, you know, he turns down money at that dinner. Later during the trial, he turns down a $30 million settlement offer from Ford. You look at that and you watch his, you know, kids dressed in bedraggled clothes, and you think, you're thinking maybe he should take it. But, you know, again, is that obstinance or is that heroic?
I don't know. I mean, we live in a culture of compromise. We live in a culture of settlements, and we have game shows about take the money. And people, I think it's funny from the audience perspective, they're unsettled. They almost have Ford's perspective by the end, you know, halfway through the movie, like, what's wrong with this guy?
Right.
Just bend a little bit and we'll all be okay here.
Mark, anything, you know, as you made this film, anything, I mean, you, as you all know, screenwriters get their ideas stolen all the time.
Absolutely.
This is, you know, this has made people crazy in Hollywood. Anything you'd fight that hard for, give up that much for?
It's hard to say. I think there probably would be something in terms of my family or something in a much more emotional way, but my point about making the movie is that most of us, and I believe this is fine, would reach a place where we couldn't go any farther. We would say, and that's the general nature of the human condition, is like you fight, and then at some point somebody rational explains to you why that fight's not going to become beneficial anymore, and the cost is going to become greater than the result. And that's when the money comes in, and most of us would say, fine, okay, I don't want to take the money. And by taking the money, I know that you're saying I agree with you. I don't, but I'm sick of fighting and everybody.
And we should say, in his case, it wasn't the money he wanted. He wanted the recognition.
He wanted
it was
the
his
recognition.
Invention. Right.
Mm-hmm. Every now and then, a man or a woman comes along and takes on a battle, and it could be as big as civil rights. It could be about nonviolence. It could be about the largest idea, and they will fight. And those type of people sometimes will fight all the way to their own death. We would have stopped before that, but because they were willing to go that far, we're the beneficiaries of their battle. I think Bob was one of those guys. It takes a somewhat selfish person. It takes a person with incredible focus. It takes someone who's not going to be bought off to do that. That's what's interesting about Bob.
One last question for you, Greg. So how are you now with windshield wipers when you're driving?
Well, I can't use my intermittent windshield wiper without thinking of our little story. And I think that the movie's not about intermittent windshield wipers, of course, but it's impossible not to recognize this tiny little device, and certainly how inspirational it was to this guy, and how, you know, it's the one thing you can tell about cars. Explain it to somebody and they kind of go, oh, yeah.
That's Greg Kinnear. He plays inventor Robert Kearns in the new film Flash of Genius. We've also been speaking with director Mark Abraham. Their film opens in theaters this Friday. Thank you both for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ron.
Thanks. Appreciate it.